Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Elliot Spitzer.
And I think this was just about the most remarkable week yet in the remarkable political season of 2008.
It was pretty remarkable.
And I think we have to say that historically people are going to look back at it and they're going to say, that was the week the NPR It's All Politics podcast recorded a 46% increase in listener.
You know what that means, Ron?
I mean, it means we're almost up to a listener and a half.
That's right.
And very soon, if we can get over 1.5, then I think we could round up to listeners.
But that is true, though. Our audience in the month of February was up 42%. That's pretty remarkable.
46%. That is correct.
I didn't realize math would be on this. You didn't tell me that.
I was told there would be no math.
Exactly.
Now, there will be those who contend that the biggest political story this week came from your home state, Ken. New York.
But I should tell you, I fled the Bronx when I was 17. I lived in Fort Lee, New Jersey for a long time. That's important.
Ken, you're not really from Fort Lee. You're from the Bronx. New York is your home state, Ken, and you just lost a governor this week.
Well, America lost its governor because a lot of people...
America's governor is Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Elliot Spitzer has always been America's governor.
But not most of America could have recognized him prior to this week.
Including
when he became,
Kristen.
Apparently did not know that she was, shall we say, entertaining a client who was also the governor of the state of New York.
But we should, in fairness, when he ran for governor in 2006, he said he would remove all the crime and the decay from New York. And
that's right.
He moved it to Washington
D.C. Yes. Exactly. Well,
I thought that was
a brilliant move on the part of the former governor. His resignation becomes effective on March 17th.
St. Patterson's Day.
St.
David Patterson, the third African-American governor of the United States since Reconstruction. Who are the other two?
The third African-American to become a governor in the United States.
Elected.
I think is the
well, to become one, right. Who are
well,
the other two?
Of course, we had Doug Wilder
in
the state of Virginia, who I believe was the first.
He was the first elected, correct?
The first elected. And I will give you the other name, Ken, since you're so eager to say it.
Deval Patrick, but...
In Massachusetts currently.
But in 1872, I believe it was, as you well remember, PBS Pinchback became governor of Louisiana because the governor resigned there. We were just discussing whether we were talking about Elliot Spitzer at all in this podcast, and we said it's old news already, but it's fascinating news. The winner by the largest landslide in the history of New York, 69%.
Where there have been some landslides.
They have been. But, I mean, this guy was Mr. Clean, was Elliot Ness, he was all these things.
And wanted to be the president of the United
States. He would have been the second Jewish president in the history of the United States.
The first having been?
Abraham Lincoln, because he was shot in the temple. I forgot about that one.
I love that joke. We decided, though, that while all of these were very important issues this week, we really had to begin with something that was a little more current, a little more ongoing, a little bit more in development, the exciting roller coaster story of Florida and Michigan.
It is exciting because, first of all, even though we're still days away, weeks away from the Pennsylvania primary, which
five and a half.
What's remarkable is that these two states that violated the rules by having the temerity to move their primaries up into January.
Oh, Joe, weren't those rules just set by Howard Dean, that mean little boy?
Not only Howard Dean, but I think everybody agreed to it, including the states of
Florida
and Michigan, right.
On the Democratic National Committee.
Right.
Where the majority of the members who have declared a presidential preference thus far are with Hillary Clinton. That is the authority that decided that Florida and Michigan could not vote before February 5th.
And now, lo and behold, of course, Hillary Clinton has been saying for weeks now that those January primary results should stand because, after all, a lot of these voters did go to the polls and voted.
In good faith. They weren't the ones who broke the rules.
Right.
They voted when their state party told them to vote. So it's scarcely the fault of the citizens of Florida and Michigan.
And it just so happens that Hillary Clinton won both. But she did say that when she was reminded this week on NPR's Morning Edition.
With Steve Inske.
That Barack Obama was not on the ballot in Michigan. She said, well, that was his decision.
Yeah, it was his fault.
Yeah.
He took his name off.
Exactly.
You know, and you got to say, that was the bonehead
move. What were you thinking?
Of 2008. What if he takes his name off the ballot in some of these other states?
Or like in November when he's a Democratic nominee.
Well, but from between now in June, he could take his name off of all those ballots, and then she'd get all the
delegates.
Oh, my
God, that's how it works.
It's the strategy.
You know what? Mark Penn deserves a lot of credit. A lot of people criticize him, but I think Mark Penn is far mightier than the sword.
It's the S word. So here's the big question, the bottom line question, the mighty question, Ken, what's going to happen? How are Michigan and Florida going to be allowed to be seated at the convention in Denver and yet not be allowed to determine who the nominee is?
Okay, we have to assume that they can't allow the January results to hold. The Obama delegates would never allow that.
Well, and also the Democratic National Committee would no longer have any ability to enforce its authority. And in 2012, we could assume every state will vote whenever it wants to. And they might be voting now. They could vote any time.
But
willy-nilly, dogs and cats living together, no rules, everything down. That's the world.
That reminds me of the time when I went into this this diner and said, breakfast served any time. So I said, okay, I'll have omelet during the Renaissance.
Stephen Wright.
Okay, well, wait a second. But if they do get to do a do-over, they could very well be king or queen makers, and therefore they have more power than ever. So what lesson does the punishment...
Their nose. Exactly. They're thumbing their nose at the rest of the country. The other 48 states, you should have voted in January too, dummies.
Texas and Ohio tried to move up too, and the fact that they didn't, I mean, they became all these states. We never thought this would last beyond February 5th, Super Tuesday.
We didn't see it coming.
And they did. And these states, these now states where these late voters who were bemoaning the fact that they had no say, that they have a major say.
Oh, in fact, look at Pennsylvania. April 22nd, nobody thought there'd be any doubt left at that time. And now they're the most important yet. So they're going to get a lot of money spent on their television stations.
Right.
And they're going to get a lot of
Michigan and Florida did not get.
They got zip. They got bupkis. And they didn't
He played for the Bears.
And how do we manage the expectations game when you have the wild card of what happens with Michigan and Florida? And it appears that Pennsylvania, at least according to the polls, and we know we have to take the polls with at least two grains of salt, indicate no chance for Barack Obama in Pennsylvania.
Well, if you're Hillary Clinton, you are on a roll. I mean, forget about Mississippi and forget about Wyoming, but the last two big states to vote were Texas and Ohio. She happened to have won then.
Primaries.
She
won the primaries, right? But in Texas, she actually winds up with fewer delegates because he won the caucuses by a bigger margin than she won the primary. Doesn't seem fair, doesn't seem very Democratic, small d, but those are the numbers.
But if you ask the man or the person on the street who had a very good day on May 4th, it would be Hillary Clinton.
March 5th. Which was earlier. And on that day, she won those primaries. And even if she doesn't get a big delegate payoff, and in fact she doesn't, especially when you subtract Wyoming and Mississippi, even so, she got her momentum back. Are those the expectations? Is that the momentum?
But there's also a number that's involved.
Oh, the delegates.
2,025. And Barack Obama, for all his so-called who cares wins in Mississippi, in Wyoming, I believe he netted as much delegates on those days as Hillary Clinton did on March 4th.
Yes, it all balanced out, given that Texas situation.
Which leads him with still over 100 delegate lead approaching.
In fact, it's getting bigger.
Yeah.
It's actually gotten a little bigger. It's up over 160 now in pledged delegates. Mm-hmm. And you subtract from that about 40 for the superdelegates.
And subtract Elliott Spitzer.
Yes, one down.
You know, something that matters.
Well, it does. So let's think about this. If you're saying that the superdelegates should have full freedom to choose between the two candidates, regardless of how many delegates each of the two candidates might have by the time we get to the convention.
Which I think they should. That's the purpose of it.
All right. If they have full freedom to do that and to disregard perhaps even the popular vote, whatever, let's look at the breakdown within the superdelegates. You hear Harold Ickes and other people in the Clinton campaign saying, these people are members of Congress. About half of them are members of Congress. But what are the facts on the breakdown? It's about one-third members of Congress, and it's about an equal number who are members of the Democratic National Committee. And it's the Democratic National Committee superdelegates who are breaking for Clinton. And in Congress, the superdelegates are split right down the middle. Equal numbers of senators, equal numbers of members of the House.
Right. But there has not been much movement lately. Is that fair to say? I mean, a lot of the Hillary superdelegates committed very early. I mean, John Lewis, the perfect example, one of the rare examples of somebody switching his or her mind.
And announcing it.
Announcing it, right. Usually you don't do that. But for the most part, many of her superdelegates committed well before Iowa, when she was the indisputable front runner and inevitable nominee.
And when, let's face it, John Lewis didn't really think Barack Obama was going to make it as a candidate and get to the point where he would be seriously conflicted as an African-American leader from Georgia, John Lewis. And then when it did get to that point, under pressure from a lot of people, he did decide to change. I think a lot of people might have also joined John Lewis, not necessarily in switching, but in announcing that they were with Obama last week, if, in fact, Obama had done a little better. If he had lost Ohio but clearly won the Texas primary in addition to the caucuses, then I think he might have been able to pick up 25, 30 more superdelegates and really begin to open up some breathing space.
Bill Richardson, John Edwards were among the rumored switchers had Barack Obama had a very good March 4th.
Former candidates, people who could throw a little support. I mean, John Edwards still has, I believe, 26 delegates or something like that.
But he stands for more than that, obviously.
Indeed, yeah, indeed. Right. And he could have been a help to her or to him in Ohio and Texas. Maybe if he were to get in at this point, he might move the ball a little bit in Pennsylvania. But, you know, that just looks like an insurmountable lead.
Well, not only that, it's hard to make the case that anybody's endorsement at this stage of the game, I mean, I mean, obviously, with Geraldine Ferraro secretly working for the Obama campaign,
we did not necessarily need another round in the racialization of the conflict between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But Jerry Ferraro made sure we got one.
Yeah, I had forgotten that Obama was an African-American candidate. But she reminded me that he wouldn't have gotten as far as he had he not been black. And I forget that it's a big advantage in this country being African-American. Well, you get jobs whenever you wanted. You become president whenever you wanted.
I've been amazed that John McCain got as far as he did.
But do you know something? For all the things, she says it wasn't a racial comment. She said the same thing in 1988 when Jesse Jackson was running for president, that he wouldn't have gotten as far as he were if had he been white. The reason he's doing so well is because he's black. He said the same thing about Jesse Jackson in April of 1988, prior to the New York primary, the very ugly primary among Al Gore, Michael Dukakis, and Jesse Jackson.
So every 20 years she just goes on television and goes into this, right?
Well, but I mean, look, is this Hillary Clinton's fault? Is it her campaign's
fault?
That
is the real question.
No, it's not.
Is this
not
a message coming from the Clinton campaign? Why did it take them so long to truly cut her loose?
Because they were so busy trashing Samantha Power for calling Hillary Clinton a monster.
All right. And there have been a lot of other people in the Obama campaign who have also made ill-advised outbursts of a personal nature against Hillary Clinton, or who have misrepresented her in some way or another, and they're all gone as well.
Well, that's what I don't understand about this whole thing. Look, is race going to be a factor in this primary? It has to be. Look at Mississippi results last Tuesday. 90% of the black vote went to Barack Obama.
70 plus percent
of the white vote went to Hillary Clinton. There is obviously a racial component here. But
that's exactly why it needs to be discussed in terms that are a little more sensitive,
right,
and a little less incendiary.
Right.
Unless what you're trying to say is, we see this as an opportunity that we can exploit
in perhaps the culturally conservative state of Pennsylvania.
Or in any of the states that have still got to vote, Kentucky, Indiana,
right,
and so on.
Right.
Turning to the Republicans, John McCain.
Okay. What
that's
else?
It for this week's political podcast.
Wait. Okay, John McCain. But the question is, does the fight between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton help John McCain because it's hurting the Democratic Party? Or is the fact that John McCain is not on the front page of any newspaper, do people forget that he's in this contest? Of course, we have plenty of time for the fall campaign.
It's March.
Right.
If I were John McCain, I wouldn't mind disappearing for a few weeks. Look what he's doing. He's traveling around to big money centers like New York and Boston, St. Louis, Chicago. He's raising money.
Right.
He's reassuring the party base. He's telling them, look at those Democrats over there. They're self-destructing. Don't worry about the economy. Don't worry about the situation in Iraq. Go ahead and put your money in another Republican presidential campaign, because in the end, it's going to be me versus one of those two. And whichever one it is, I'm going to clean the floor with.
How about this? While they're fighting over petty and picayune things, I am answering the phone at 3 a.m.
Absolutely, even if I have to call myself. And I think that there is a real sense that the Republican Party, even if it's not going to be able to make gains in Congress and get back into the majority there, and even if they aren't going to have a great year across the board, they're going to have probably a very difficult year across the board in 2008. They can still hold on to the White House. They still have a tremendous advantage in the Electoral College. And they still have that contrast between the personality of John McCain and the unity of their party about John McCain, if they do eventually reach it, and I think they will, and what's going on the Democratic side. So right now, stay off the front page.
But I still say that the issues still favor the Democratic Party. I still think that this fight, if it's solved earlier than later, it certainly helps the Democratic Party. And you mentioned the word Congress. Look at what happened last Saturday.
Bill Foster.
Exactly. Bill Foster.
Household name now. Everybody in the country talking about Bill Foster.
My parents were named after them.
Very, very
famous. I have
Foster
man. Parents, mm-hmm. Yes.
And why do we all know his name now, Ken?
Because he won Dennis Hastert's congressional seat in Illinois 14. Not only did he win the seat, I went back to 1920. It's only the third time since then that district went for a Democrat. It went for one in 1932, who was defeated in 1934. It went for Tim Lee Hall in 1974. Wait, come on, it's all politics. But it's only the third time in the last 90 years that a Democrat won the seat.
This is a district that it is so congenital. Republican.
Can you say that word on the air?
Yes.
With the Elliot Spitzer thing?
Republican.
No, congenitally is what I...
Across the entire swath of the northern part of the state, you go from the Chicago suburbs almost to the Mississippi River. Dennis Hastert serving longer as a Republican speaker than anybody in history, and they
a
chose
Democrat.
A Democrat.
Third time.
In a special election.
Yes.
When turnout is actually tends to be fairly low. Now, if Bill Foster can hold on to this job in November, that then becomes a symbol for what is a very discouraging outlook for Republicans, e.g., where people retire And they have 28, 29 retirements so far, the Republicans.
25.
25. Right. And then, of course, there have been some people who have already left, so maybe that's why I'm counting to get that little higher number. They have had all these retirements, and about half the 25 you're talking about look quite vulnerable right now. And maybe two-thirds of the toss-up seats between the two parties are Republican-held at this point.
And exactly. And what are the kind of seats that one party or the other will take away? If you go back to 1994, a lot of them, not so much incumbents defeated, though there were plenty of them, but it's the open seats. If you look at the Senate, when the Republicans won the Senate in 1994, they were all open seats.
Tell it, brother.
But in fairness, this is the Republican argument, which Jim Oberweis was the Republican candidate who was not a likable guy. He had run twice for the Senate in the primary,
both
multimillionaire. He rubbed Republicans the wrong way.
Which is never a good idea.
And he will be the nominee again in November. But again, if you remember the special elections in the Watergate year of 1974.
Well, I do.
John Murtha won historically Republican district in a special election that February, and people wanted to know if it would be a bellwether.
And that's really the fear that has to get into a lot of Republicans, that they're not only going to remain in the minority, but they're going to drop. They've already dropped below 200 seats in this Congress, that they're going to drop below the 192 seats that was their kind of historic stopping point back in the 70s and 80s, and that they could drop even further than that, empowering the Democrats in the House and making life either more difficult for John McCain as president or making a lot of laws if one of the two Democrats gets elected.
A quick thing on the recent primaries in Louisiana 6, in the seat that Richard Baker is retiring.
Richard Baker, Republican.
Republican. In the special election there, even though it goes to a runoff and things like that, far more Democrats turned out in their primary than on the Republican side.
This is not New Orleans.
Exactly. This is Republican country in Louisiana. Another thing interesting in this special election on Tuesday, Andre Carson, the late Julia Carson's
grandson,
becomes the second Muslim ever elected to Congress after Keith Ellison. So that's something that's of interest. He does face a 6- or 7-way primary in May, but I think that's worth something. Also, Mike Cerisi, the trial attorney who was running for the Senate in Minnesota, against Al Franken.
Dropped out of the race. Al Franken, now the nominee.
That's right.
Against Norm Coleman.
That's
in
right.
Minnesota. That will certainly be a race to watch, huh, Ken? That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/elections.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.